Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with the Remarkable Mind series, we're going to look at the state of American consciousness. My guest from Princeton, New Jersey is Chris Hedges. Chris is one of our nation's most insightful cultural critics and social and political activist and investigative journalist. For almost 20 years, he was a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, having reported for the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, and other outlets. And while at the New York Times, Chris received the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for reporting on global terrorism. That same year, he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. Chris has authored many best-selling books. His most recent is Unspeakable, Talks with David Talbot About the Most Forbidden Topic in America. It's a candid conversation on some of the most important issues and themes of our times that mainstream media refuses to discuss. Chris's weekly talk show, On Contact, interviews prominent dissidents ignored by the media and airs every Saturday on Russian TV or RTV.com. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Thanks, Gary.
We could certainly spend time focusing our attention on Trump and his cabinet appointees in the direction of the nations right now. However, I feel what is, at least for me, far more important is the popular state of American consciousness that has given rise not only to Trump as a phenomenon, but also perpetuates the myth of the Democratic Party as a viable antidote and alternative. It was about 8 years ago that you published an entire book on this subject, Empire of Illusions, where you defined a variety of illusions that Americans live by and that are the basis for worldviews. Those include the myths people hold about the nation and its role in the world, the illusions of our faux democracy, the decline of literacy and surrendering our critical thinking to the entertainment industry and the mainstream media, our perversion of love and human higher consciousness and universal qualities, the dumbing down of education whereby acquisition of wisdom is a lost art, and then our illusion about happiness and satisfaction that is completely defined by consumerism, materialism, and commercialism. So if you reflect back 8 years when you published that book and then consider the present, how do you see any of these particular illusions as having been a major contributor to the election of Trump and the backlash alternative vote for Clinton? And the second, right now, how do these illusions define what America has become today? The form is yours.
Well, Trump himself is an illusion. He is the creation of a reality television show. He has a manufactured personality as a great business tycoon, which is not. And so his fictional persona, I think he was in The Apprentice for 12 seasons, was accepted as real. I mean, Hillary Clinton also has a fictional persona. Our political candidates have manufactured personalities. Politics itself has become political theater. You have skilled public relations firms and publicists and advertising agencies and everything else constantly taking the pulse of the public to get them to feel a certain way about a candidate so that emotion is confused with knowledge. And Trump just tapped into that game, which is leached into the political arena as well. And in fact, proved better at it than the politicians. And that's why CNN had its banner year last year. They made more money last year than they've ever made in this year's, because he was entertaining. The media is deeply complicit in the rise of Trump. He got 23 times the television coverage of Bernie Sanders. I think they spent more time filming an empty podium waiting for Trump to appear than they did for Sanders virtually. So it is all, you know, it is all kind of, it's pervasive throughout the culture, it's pervasive within the political process, and it conditioned us for a Trump, and that's how we got Trump.
Would we have had Trump had the Democratic and liberal establishment honored the promises that it had made, or what had been a historical mandate to seek ways of helping resolve the suffering of those who are trapped in perpetual debt and poverty in this country, which it doesn't seem anybody has been paying attention to for the last 36 years.
Right. No, we wouldn't have had Trump. I mean, what we got, courtesy of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, who was very much a part of his effort, was a faux liberal wing of the Democratic Party, a faux liberal class, a class that knew that if it did corporate bidding, it would get corporate money, so that by the 1990s, the Democratic Party has fundraising parity with the Republicans. Clintons rose to political power by dismantling the advances that have been made by Jesse Jackson under the Rainbow Coalition, speaking again in the coded words of to white racists, super predators, law and order. I think Clinton expanded the death penalty for something like, with Biden, to 53 crimes, the three strikes you're outlaws, the explosion of the prison population of the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, the deregulation of the FCC, which is, by the way, how Stephen Bannon made his money. All of this was Clinton, and so it worked for about three decades. People saw the con. It was as much a con as Trump, and that was the reaction. And the tragedy, of course, is that I think that in a fair primary process, i.e. one by which you remove corporate money, Clinton would not have stood a chance. Sanders would have easily been the nominee. But the Democratic Party was never going to allow that to happen, which was always my critique of his decision to run as a Democratic candidate. But what's even more astounding is that after the election, they've learned nothing. Schumer's primary role in the Democratic Party is to collect money from Wall Street and distribute it to candidates, tens of millions of dollars. And they are just not going to surrender their privileged perch within the party and within the political establishment. And they realize that if money was extracted from politics, if we had serious campaign finance, they'd all go to, they'd become extinct. And so they're playing, I think, a foolish and a dangerous game, which is to remain as corrupt and reviled as they have been in the past and hope that Trump implodes and they'll inherit power. I'm not sure that's going to work. No, if they had not betrayed the middle class, working men and women, the poor, we wouldn't have a Trump. And this is something that I and other writers have been saying now for well over a decade.
I come from West Virginia, Chris. I'm a hillbilly. And I grew up there in Parkersburg, went to college there, Mountain State College. I lived in Wheeling and Weirton, steel towns, and before I came to New York. And when you grow up in a community, and it's a small state, I can drive from one end of the state to the other, from Huntington to Wheeling in about 2 hours. You get to know the people. And there's a tiny little town, only has about 400 people, down at the end of West Virginia near Bluefield in the coal mine country. I mean, smack in the middle of coal mine country. It also is where the High River joins, where you have Kentucky and Virginia and West Virginia. Tennessee, it's all very close. So you have this similar culture. When I graduated from college, there were already closing down some of the mines, and poverty was common then. When I have gone back, I've seen communities that do everything they can to help the people within their community. The church is generally very important in small communities, as you know. And so they try to have outreach. And the older generation generally can't find work, don't want to leave the community. There's kind of a fear of going out into the unknown for a lot of older people because all they know is coal mining, and they haven't been schooled in anything else. the younger people, the kids that have never worked in a coal mine but have not seen their family work in 10, 15, 20 years, they're using a lot of drugs. In fact, one community, this Kermit, West Virginia, population 400, had 9 million prescriptions, pills of OxyContin given to it. And when you look at how many that is per person, and not everyone in the community was taking it, it's mainly for pain, but it's an opiate, and it really adversely affects a person's perception and their reality. They just go into this la-la land, and they stay there. So when I'm talking with the people, the word on the street is that the younger people used the drug and the older people drank. And between the two of drinking and the older population and the drugs and the younger population, they don't see a way out. So anytime a population, and I was, here's what they told me on my last trip. Every politician from Ronald Reagan on comes through here and makes promises. The trouble is they never deliver. We're hearing promises, they come, and that's it. And yet we have a life that we have to live, and yet we have nothing. And so then I hear, and these are not racist people, by the way. All the people I know that I grew up with who are poor, they're not white supremacists. They're not a part of the Ku Klux Klan. They're just people who, by and large, just would like to have a job, to have security for their family, a roof, food, clothing, a school, so that their kids can have a better life than they had. Just basic, soldier people. Now, this also, when I went to Detroit, and I spent a lot of time in Detroit, I found that was true. When I recently went into Camden, New Jersey, in fact, the police told me, don't go down that street. And I said, I'm sorry, but I'm filming, and I got to go where the people are. They said, well, you're going to get in trouble. They'll steal it. I said, I don't think so. I went down there, and I walked by a house, and there was no door. And so I went in, and I said, hello, anyone there? And a guy comes out. He said, yeah. I said, why are you living here? He said, it's cheaper for me to come over here and to buy drugs for my pain than it is to get the medical help over there in Philadelphia, right across the river. You can see, you know, Philadelphia from Camden. And Camden at once was one of the most prosperous cities in the United States. It was the ship capital, and RCA Victor and Campbell Soup. And I said, why don't you have a door? And this is what he said. He said, because they break it in and then they'll beat you up. So if I don't have a door, they just come in and they see I don't have anything and they won't beat me up. But otherwise, every time they have a door, they beat me up. And I saw the guy had teeth knocked out. He had lacerations on his face. So I asked him, what did you do before you ended up here? And he had been a steel worker, but he'd been out of work now for 12 years and he had no income and he was too young for Social Security. And so this was the only choice he thought he had, and he was not the only one. I went down those mean streets of Camden, and I talked with gang members, and I went up to him, and I said, why are you living here? What's your life like? What's it like to be where nobody comes? And they told me their story. And then I hear Hillary Clinton call them the deplorables, and I hear people attacking him, and damn, that makes me mad, because they're not out there. You and I go out there. You know, we spend lots of time talking with people. Yeah, they're deplorable people out there. But to relegate all of those people out there who voted for Trump as deplorable instead of asking why would they have voted for him? And what happened when you, Mrs. Clinton, and your husband made promises, and how many of those people ended up losing whatever welfare they did have or what jobs they had from NAFTA? Nobody in the media is asking that question. And so you have been down those streets. Very few journalists have. Tell us about what you see when you travel throughout America. The people have been called all kinds of names, lazy, and when they would love a job. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, I did a book with Joe Sacco, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, where we wrote it out of the poorest pockets of the United States, including Camden, which, as you know, per capita is the poorest city in America, or it was when we wrote in our book. It also, per capita, was the most dangerous city in America when we wrote it. I was in West Virginia in the coal camps. And you're right, we'd start doing interviews, and it was clear everybody, especially the young people, were on OxyContin. It was like interviewing zombies. The despair has just become so great that people attempt to anesthetize themselves. They know there's no hope. They know there's no way out. They haven't been offered any kind of and education, opportunities for education, and it's heartbreaking. And that segment of America, which arguably now is over half the country, maybe more, is invisible because our media is controlled by a handful of corporations. Again, let's go back to Clinton, which made this possible, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. And it's all about revenue. It's all about advertising. It's all about ratings. It's all about attracting viewers. And I'm talking about the news. There are what passes for news. So these people have not only been sold out by the political class and by the economic elites, but they've been sold out by the press, who stopped giving them a voice. Or if they did give them a voice, it was to ridicule them on shows like Jerry Springer or denounce them as deplorables, which is a form of kind of institutional bigotry. And that's why there was an Emerson, I think it was a Emerson College poll. It was a recent poll that said that about 39% of Americans trust the press and 49% trust Trump. And I understand that poll. The press has utterly failed in its role, which is to lift up the voices of citizens, especially citizens who wouldn't have a voice without the press. Yeah, the despair is real. I mean, the racism is there, it exists, but it's not the engine that drove people into the arms of Trump. It is the perfidy and the mendacity of the ruling elites, and in particular, the liberal class. So what we saw was not only a rejection of the self-identified liberal establishment, but a rejection of the supposed liberal values that they espoused. Well, of course, these values only applied to the elite. So feminism was about electing a woman president or a woman senator or a woman CEO. It wasn't about empowering oppressed women. They completely invert, what does multiculturalism mean? Well, it means having an African-American president who, as Cornel West says, is a black mascot for Wall Street. So I really think that the roots of this go back to the bankruptcy of a liberal establishment that, made kind of great short-term gains. I mean, the Clintons, of course, are extremely wealthy, and I'm sure Obama will be through his foundation. But at the expense of our democracy, at the expense of the country, and certainly at the expense of the vulnerable.
There are many of us who have disengaged our allegiance to either Washington, certainly Wall Street a long time ago, and stand on the margins of political correctness, who have observed the ascent of fascist or totalitarian ideas and principles and policies over the years. And what is more disturbing is that the large majority of Americans don't observe this unfolding, and that requires a certain kind of mentality that prefers to wear blinders to keep their myths and illusions alive. Your friend, Henry Giroux, writes about this a lot. Why is it so difficult for most Americans to be able to critically look at the nation and our politicians?
Oh, a couple reasons. One, I think people, having lived through, for instance, the collapse of Yugoslavia, I'm much more attuned to the kind of warning signs for despotism and for a failed democracy. American exceptionalism is a powerful belief system. And I think it is coupled with an emotional inability, and not this isn't true just for Americans, but for most peoples, to recognize that the relative stability of the old order can completely disintegrate. I mean, I would see this on the eve of countries that were about to go into war. People just, although all the palpable signs around them showed that war was inevitable, there was just an emotional incapacity to grapple with what was coming. And I think that's true in terms of the collapse of American democracy. We no longer live in a democracy. This was true before Trump. The institutions, the rhetoric, they all remain. But as Sheldon Wolin says, internally, corporations have long ago seized all of the levers of power to render the citizen impotent, and that's an emotional, that's a truth that is emotionally difficult to grapple with, especially for Americans who see themselves as an exceptional people, as a kind of beacon of freedom and hope to the rest of the world. I mean, this has long not been true, especially in places like the Middle East. And you're not getting people within the mainstream discourse who are acknowledging the reality. They still speak as if we live in a functioning democracy. And so, yeah, it's I think part, and I think this is also wrapped up, you talked about my book, Empire of Illusion, with severing ourselves from a print-based culture, which most of the population has done. So we're not literate in many ways in terms of economics and how it works, or even politics and how it works. There's some great work out there. But the state doesn't really have to worry about it, because the percentage of Americans who sit down and actually read this stuff is minuscule. So, yeah, I think for all of those reasons, we're pretty blind. I mean, we're probably arguably the most illusioned nation on the planet at this point.
It was in the mid-1970s, I began to see the shift away from local businesses or corporations that had been well-run and where there was good union representation. So there was a thriving middle class, thriving both urban and suburban environments. And the people who ran the corporations more often than not had lived in the corporations their entire lives. That was certainly true where I grew up. And then you started to see the green mailers, the people with get on your board or buy a lot of stock with the intention that you're going to give them a lot of money to go away. And it happened. And then the corporate takeovers, the Carl Icahns, the T. Boone Pickens, the Michael Milkins, the handful of people, Saul Steinberg, there were about five people that really terrified corporate America. But also then I saw something happening. One corporation after another was allowing itself to be purchased, enormous gains for those that controlled it or its shareholders, and then that company was downsized. But it took about 30 years before we began to really understand this was not a small event. Between 2000, and I'm talking about from 1970 to 2000, you're talking about 30 years there. But from 2000 to 2014, that's the latest figures I have, 58,000 factories, whole factories, closed down, many of them because they were purchased and it was cheaper to offshore their jobs in other countries. So when I did the math on this, and there were no figures available, I had to go back year by year and see how many companies were purchased, how many downsized. It was all about loading companies up with debt, where before they'd been well-run. Linens and Things, that's one. Circuit City, that's another. But there are over 4,000 companies that have been bought, merged by equity partners. They took their profit out, and workers then began to lose their jobs, and all that was of value was the brand, the trademark. So you could make a Frigidaire, you could make a bicycle in China for less than it would cost ever to make it in the United States. I did not see protests. I did not see the media directing our attention to this phenomenon. I did not see politicians talking about it, nor did I see society as a whole say, hold on a second, they're closing our plant and we've had our livelihood here. This should concern all of us, because if they're doing it here, and they can do it anywhere. Our thought was, well, it's only in Flint, Michigan, or Dearborn, Michigan. No, it was everywhere. Every state had this phenomenon happen thousands of times. I estimate approximately 28 million Americans in that 45-year period lost their livelihoods and had to find other work in either the same industry or be re-educated in different industries, on almost always downsizing, meaning they were working longer for less. Standard of living went down. Debts increased. Could you address this phenomena that we seem as a society be living in some euphoric sense of cognitive disconnect? We're not using our consciousness in the moment we're in to see the consequences of our actions or other actions of people saying they're doing something for our benefit, and that it never is. Your thoughts?
Well, the critics at the time, there were a few Sheldon Wolin being one, were very swiftly blacklisted. Everybody had to buy on to the neoliberal mantra, which is a utopian belief system and a kind of ridiculous one, the idea that the dictates of a marketplace should determine how you run every aspect of your society. This is kind of flies in the face of a few thousand years of political science. If we go back to Plato, it's an absurd ideology. That it will spread democracy, that it will, expand the middle class. None of it made any economic sense. But it became the unquestioned form of progress, and any questioning of it became heretical. So whether it was in the media, whether it was in academia, and corporations, of course, had a vested interest in promoting this ideology because it swelled their profits. Go back to Karl Marx. He talks about any ruling ideology essentially serves the interests of the ruling capitalist elites, and this was certainly true in the case of neoliberalism. But critics of neoliberalism couldn't get tenure. They couldn't function in the press. There was a complete silence that was imposed, and everybody chanted that, the slogans of Thomas Friedman being kind of the classic example, or they didn't find work, they didn't find a place. So it was very difficult for the wider public to grasp. They could grasp what was, as you correctly point out, on a local level what was happening, but it was harder for them to grasp because this mantra came with the idea that the tech industry would take over and it will create new jobs, and all of which was untrue, but it was repeated and embraced by across the cultural and political spectrum. And that propaganda for many, many years, I think, masked the devastation that has now been visited upon the United States and our elites, including, of course, our media elites and intellectuals and academic elites, who found it convenient to mouth that ideology, is certainly convenient for their careers, bear a great deal of responsibility for what's happened, because they were also part of this class of privileged people who sold out working men and women. And again, that's why you see the backlash, and I think it's a legitimate backlash against them.
I've spent the last 12 years working almost full-time on a project concerning the current state of our climate in the world. And about 2 months ago, I finished the last of the interviews for a documentary I'm doing on saving the planet. And there were 12 environmentalists. These are people who are not showboating. They're very self-effacing people. One's a professor emeritus of Environmental Science, University of Arizona. They all have impeccable backgrounds. Now, here's what they said. They all said that the Anthropocene 6th extinction we're in now no longer has any viable or controllable markers. We are in chaos theory. And the best they can do, based upon multiple feedback loops that are now affecting one and another. One time there was only 7 tipping points. Now there's over 40 tipping points. And they say that they all said the same thing. They all, independent of one another, said that the worst tipping point is the loss of sea ice in the Arctic. And they expect that the first completely free Arctic sea ice will be this summer. And even today on Robert Scribblers.com, Kevin Hester talked about, quote, what's happening is that the ice has experienced 3 consecutive very warm winter periods in a row, 2015, 16, and now 17. The Australian Bureau of Meteorology has us on El Nino watch. If it kicks in, it will decimate the already bleached Great Barrier Reef and destroy the already fragile young thin ice remaining. The perfect storm. Think Shankova, 50 megatons of methane awaiting release, meaning the methane at the bottom of the shallow Arctic is going to be released. Siberia now has 7 1,000 gigantic holes. These are methane holes. Now, we're talking about something you could put a football field across the length and width of this hole, and it still wouldn't match it. We're talking about deep, big holes that did not exist before. This is methane gases. And when you look at the methane held in Siberia, the tundras, the Boreal Forest, Norway, when these start to melt because of heating and the gas is released, methane is a minimum of 26 to as high as 68 times the impact of CO2. We're going to have an uncontrollable, as they say, jump in our temperatures, which will then create massive heat that we have never experienced on Earth, or not in the, in our generations. And that's going to affect the growing of seeds. It's going to affect weather patterns. It's going to affect availability of water. Now, I give you this as background because when I'm broadcasting these topics, when I go to do a lecture on these topics, they are the least interested group of people come. I'm amazed at how few people want to hear this information. And so we seem to be living in a common denial of the consequences of cause and effect. It's like nobody wants to acknowledge that the oceans are going to rise, but not gradually, as we were told. Remember, we were told the Larsen B shelf will drop in about 100 to 150 years. It dropped 9 days later. Now the Larsen B shelf is about that holds most of Antarctica in place. It's 100 miles long. It's 300 yards wide, and it's a mile deep, and it's going to break in the next couple of weeks, according to the latest reports. That means that there's nothing going to be holding the glaciers from sliding into the ocean, and it's heating up underneath and on top. So when you look at every part of our environment, every single part, it shows that we are now creating non-sustainable environments. We're moving to non-sustainable states like Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, most of California, most of Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Colorado. We do not have water for people in the future. People are running out of water now. And yet, with 12,000 extreme weather events in the last 12 months in the United States, the worst sandstorm, a 3-mile-high, 7-mile-long sandstorm that they've never seen in Arizona history, no one's reporting on this stuff. No one reported that in one parish, 67,000 homes were destroyed in Louisiana just 5 months ago. And there was no flood insurance because it had never flooded there. So these people have no homes to go back to. It's no longer in the news cycle. Fukushima, it's far worse. It's 5 times worse than what we've ever been told because they finally got a measurement that was accurate inside. And now it's really devastating. It's not reported on. So A, the media is not touching on any of this stuff except just to report an individual episode. And B, the people of the world are not planning on where's our plan B? What do we do? So when we talk about governments not being prepared, politicians not being prepared, including Obama, none of these people did anything that actually shifted us off the methane-producing foods like meat, off the fuels like nuclear and gas and hydrofracking, to a sustainable one, one that could actually protect our environment. None of the politicians done anything about it. And these conferences don't mean anything, and the public doesn't seem to care. What do you make of this?
Well, I blame the systems of information. What do they spend all their time talking about? It is the latest tweet by Donald Trump, or you know, whatever absurdity is being bantered back and forth within the establishment. Because you're right. I mean, this is the issue. 2016 was the hottest global average among thermometer measurements stretching back to 1880. And in terms of the research, the last time the world was this warm was 115,000 years ago. And we have not experienced these levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for 4 million years. The figures that are coming out, including there's a new report by the World Meteorological Organization, which calls this moment in our ecocide truly uncharted territory. So if we were a rational culture, every single night we would be discussing these issues over public broadcasting, which unfortunately has been destroyed by the Koch brothers and is now about, if Trump gets his way, to be utterly defunded. And Trump himself is moving to cut climate change research within the EPA. So, especially as a father, it's truly terrifying. And you're right, there is. Our response has been to retreat into self-delusion by just pretending it's not happening. Although, again, as I mentioned earlier, all of the warning signs are around us, including the melting of the ice caps and the warming of the oceans.
Just today, Chris, The Guardian said, quote, record-breaking climate change pushes world into uncharted waters. Also, from the Common Sense, and Helen Collicott has stated, Fukushima is officially now an extinction-level event. It is extremely important. And Arne Gundersen, who went to Japan, who is a great deep experiences in engineering nuclear issues, measured hotspots all over Tokyo, the most populated city in the world with 40 million people in a relatively small area, and every single one of the measurements showed unacceptable levels of radiation, yet the people of Japan are not aware of this. They've been lied to by their government, and yet that radiation is going into the air, it's going into the water, it's in the seafood that people consume. And there's no discussion of these things. If you can't change unless you know what to change from, and you can't have that discussion if you don't have people who are open to having a discussion. And we just don't seem to want to look at the reality of where we're at today.
Well, that unfortunately is not common. It is common among civilizations in terminal decline, such as ours. Although this time, when we go down, we're going to bring the rest of the world with us. And you go back and look at the collapse of the Roman Empire, and you go back and look at the collapse of the Greek city-states and the rise of despotism in ancient Athens, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. There is this bizarre psychological need to retreat into a world of utter moral depravity, unchecked hedonism. Incredible, the loss of the common good, the breakdown of community, and this amazing denial of reality. And then, of course, when everything unravels, as anthropologists have documented, people tend to retreat into crisis cults. That's what the ghost dance was about at Wounded Knee, the idea that you could, after hours of dancing, throw yourself into a kind of Sufi-like trance, and if you put on a special shirt, white man's bullets wouldn't go through you, and the buffalo herds would come back, and the great warriors who were exterminated by the Euro-Americans would rise up from the dead, and the white people would disappear. And this is common. We saw it with millennialist movements in Europe and the 15th century. This is a kind of common phenomenon, and our technology is advanced, but our DNA is not really any different. And I think we're responding in a very similar kind of way that populations on the cusp of having their societies unravel respond. And the great tragedy is that with climate change, there will be no new lands to occupy, or in the case of empire, no new peoples to subjugate. This is it.
Even today, Yahoo.com, Siberian permafrost, over 7,000 methane-filled bubbles. These are gas-filled holes, by the way, that I just mentioned, and they're just now talking about this today. These have been going on for a couple of years, and I'm very concerned about the environment because last year, the Earth had 123,000 extreme events. And when we hear about these events, we say, okay, that's over there, that's not here. But then here, we have these extreme events, and we say, well, that's there in that state, in Louisiana, it's in Virginia, it's in Wisconsin. We had three of those this year, massive flooding. That we had seven once-in-500-year events in the last 12 months in the United States. And And yet I ask people who live in Los Angeles, and I say, what are you doing for the future? What do you mean? Well, your government is not telling you the full truth. You're on an earthquake fault line. The Fukushima radiation is hitting you. You have fish that you cannot consume out of the Pacific or seaweed. And the temperature is rising. And don't confuse the rain that you just had from that extreme storm that temporarily filled up the aquifers, because 95% of that water went off to where it can't be used in the ocean and in the sewers. Now you're going to be left with drought again. And after this rain comes new greens, and greens pop up. And now you're going to have fires when that dries in the next drought. So are you doing anything? And the answer was, if it was that bad, Gary, the government would tell us. Okay, you're partly correct. But also, if it was that bad, if the government tells you, people are going to start moving, property taxes are going to go down, municipalities in the state won't have the tax base to support itself and its bureaucracies, and nobody wants to be that bad. Well, when these scientists told me, we have about 9 years before society begins to implode, collapse, based upon these extreme events, where whole areas you won't be able to grow in because it'll be too hot. The sun will kill any of the seeds, or it'll be so wet, it'll rot them out. And I'm thinking, 9 years? Are you sure? So all these people said the same thing. Optimistically, it's 9 years. It could be sooner, maybe a little later, based upon the feedlap looseness, all based upon the melting of the ice in the Arctic. And I say, why don't we have some real serious discussions with these scientists? Because I said, well, why don't the other 2,000-plus scientists say anything? They said, because they're tied into grants. They're tied into where they cannot talk. They have to vet everything they say. They cannot say anything that would terrify people. I said, but it's not about terrifying people. It's about informing people. We didn't inform people. We didn't inform parents about how bad sugar was. We didn't inform about aspartame. We didn't inform about DDT or the Agent Orange effect, 4-2-4-T, about the Vietnam soldiers who came back polluted with it. We didn't inform the Iraqis, our own soldiers, about depleted uranium in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia. We didn't inform anyone about what happens when you have 1.1 billion people are food insecure, and over 300 million in Africa are food insecure, and they're going to be refugees, food refugees, not Civil War refugees. That's separate. So it doesn't seem like we're capable at this moment, Chris, in the mainstream media or in our body politic to inform people of the real crisis, multiple crisis that we have facing us. Your thoughts?
Well, precisely, because at this point, every institution and every policy decision is driven by the primacy of corporate profit. And if you started telling people the truth, it would be a gigantic disruption. I mean, you and I know the extent to which the animal agriculture industry has created these gag laws to cover up not only the extent to which the animal agriculture industry contributes to climate change, and I think there's a strong argument that it's even worse than fossil fuels, but the health effects, the way that it pollutes, and it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you're just not going to, I mean, McGovern was the last politician to try and confront the animal agriculture industry, and they made sure he didn't get reelected to the Senate. From South Dakota. So at this point, you know, we've undergone, as John Ralston says, this corporate coup d'etat. And these people don't think beyond the money that they're going to make, perhaps even in quarterly. And everything else is, I mean, they're stunted, deformed, often psychopathic individuals. They have tremendous sums of wealth, unlimited political power. They control the discussion. They control the media landscape. They control most of our universities. So in essence, as you correctly point out, they buy the silence of people who should be speaking out because they don't want to lose their positions. They don't want to lose their research funding. They don't want to be marginalized within their own academic disciplines, and we're all paying for it. And that gets back to the fact that we no longer live in a free state, in a sense that where there is actual freedom of discussion and freedom of debate. That's all gone. We're rapidly reconfiguring ourselves into a much more draconian police state, something that poor people of color have now been enduring for many years. But both the legal and the physical mechanisms of control that are very familiar to poor and poor people of color are going to be employed against the rest of us. We're seeing with all these states that are passing these laws against protest and against dissent, where they can charge you with felony convictions and seize your property, and the elites, on especially the security and surveillance apparatus, they know very well what's coming, and they are preparing both the physical and the legal mechanisms by which a population that perhaps might wake up will be kept under control.
By the way, as an aside to what you just said, I received a call because I'm a certified organic farmer, and I have been since the Fertler Farm, the first organic teaching farm in New York State that I founded back in 1972. And so they called, and I asked them who they were, and they were calling through a state agency on behalf of Homeland Security. What are you growing? How much are you growing? Where are you storing it? Is it fresh or dried? Which buildings do you put it in? What is the volume of it? And I'm saying, why should I tell you this? Well, and the person was very, I was surprised they didn't defend anything. They said, in case there's ever an emergency, that will be confiscated. What about my needs, my family's needs? That you'll have to take up with the state. Well, who exactly is supposed to get my food that I'm growing? Well, the government. And I didn't realize that Obama had signed an executive order allowing for the confiscation of anyone and everyone's food, including all those food banks that people had. That's just as an aside to show you how that deep state works. By the way, on an aside, EchoWatch today talked about how the EPA is moving to ditch clean car standards at the request of the automobile makers. That is a payback to the automobile industry, to Donald Trump, or getting in their good favor. And think of what that's going to mean when Ralph Nader, who originally got the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, all that effort that all of us who are environmentalists made behind Ralph Nader, it's all being wiped away now.
Yeah.
Every day,
yeah,
something else is being wiped away. Right. Well, what's going to be left? And we have to be paying attention to this. One other thing before we run out of time. Recently, I had Rabbi Abraham Heschel's daughter, Susanna, from Dartmouth, on the program to speak about the Christian fascism in the Tea Party. But there's also another ideology I'm hoping you might be able to speak about, and which gets very little attention, and that is the traditionalism, which has a kind of quasi-esoteric origins with the Italian fascist, Julius Evola, and later René Guémenon. And this traditionalism, which has a kind of a hold on a lot of people, I think Steve Bannon is one of them. Bannon is also part of that radical Catholic right sector and that opposed Pope Francis. Can you speak about this conservative traditionalism that is now very likely a motivating factor in the America Trump is trying to create?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much this characterizes Trump, but it certainly characterizes Bannon. I don't know that Trump has much of an ideology. And I think that that ideological vacuum of Trump will be filled by the Christian right and by this traditionalist school, which Bannon is close to. And the traditionalists argue that there are a kind of primordial or universal religious truths that come out of the Christian religion, and that these truths are absolute, and that the farther the society goes from those absolute truths, the more decay that society endures. This, by the way, was very similar to Plato. And so it is a kind of strange mysticism. It believes in the power of a divine inspiration. It believes that only certain figures are able to discern this sacred wisdom, and then the traditionalists, people like Bannon, obviously have a sense that they have tapped into this wisdom that is denied to or been lost in the modern world. It is essentially a totalitarian embrace under religious guise of Lenin's vanguard, that you possess an absolute truth that others can't see, and you are empowered to act on that truth in the interests of everyone, although the vast majority can't understand that you are acting in their interests, kind of like Cardinal Bellarmine burning Giordano Bruno at the stake because he saved heretics from their own damnation. It's kind of comes out of that kind of bizarre religious fascist ideology. But yes, it is. I think the Christian right is probably more apt to fill the power vacuum in the United States, but this certainly explains Bannon's worldview. This is what he comes out of.
Final question. I voted for Ralph Nader and also supported Jill Stein twice. I would have a group of people, Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, Rocky Anderson on, and I would ask them, just tell me yes or no. No explanation is necessary at this time. Do you support single payer or not? It was yes or no. Do you support closing down the 900-plus military base around the world? Do you support a person's right to know what's in their food? I went through all these. Do you support taking all money out of elections? Of 40 different topics that clearly were populist and would help measurably the globe, people, income disparity, and they said yes to every single one correctly. Now, when I looked at what Trump and Clinton and Obama had been advocating, they said no to every single one. They came down on, would you reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act? Jill Stein said yes. Rocky Anderson, yes. But there are others, no. Would you support the, would you support eliminating all trade deals that in any way have encumbered the United States, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, NAFTA? They said yes. The others said no. So why is it with 1 million votes, under one half of 1%, Jill Stein got, and yet she didn't get any of the big debates, but she still had a lot of media. Why is it Americans are not willing to vote for a person that really would help them and are voting for people that can only lead to destruction?
Well, I think a lot of it is the media, because the media, who considers a candidate credible largely by the amount of money they raise that month, writes them off as irrelevant and will pound them as day after day as not being a serious alternative or any kind of an alternative. I mean, I also voted for Stein and, as you know, worked for Ralph and have just heard over and over again you know, if anything, within the mainstream, I'm talking about the liberal class, that we're responsible for electing Bush, or we're responsible for electing Trump, when in fact, of course, it's the betrayal by the liberal elites, the Democratic elites, that's responsible for electing Trump. Brainwashing works. I mean, this kind of mantra, these kinds of messages, even cliches and slogans, are just repeated ad nauseum until people ingest them as their own. You know, getting back to was Nader responsible for Bush's election in 2000? Just factually incorrect. Even Gore says now that he won Florida. So I think, again, it's the narrowing of debate within the national discourse because of the media. It's like Dorothy Parker once said about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range as an actress. It goes from A to B. Well, that's kind of where we are. So what's an acceptable debate about Syria? Should we just bomb Syria, or should we bomb Syria and put boots on the ground, as if those are the two options? And those of us, and I spent 7 years in the Middle East, I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, those of us come out of the region and realize that those are not the only two options, but who defy the dominant narrative are locked out.
I am optimistic at one level here, because I'm inspired by the words of former Black Panther activist Erica Huggins, who teaches at Merritt College in Oakland, California. She said that once the heart is awakened, we can't help but speak the truth. And if we perceive the environment as being our situation in life, our surroundings, our communities, our identities, then there are invisible environmental prisons and reservations all around us, but we can see them. We surrounded ourselves with the wrong energy, and I believe that a lot of us, yourself included, understand that our answers, our solutions must have not only an activist political component, but also coming from a deep-rooted spiritual commitment to all lives and to the environment. Your final thought, please.
I mean, the other counter-narrative, that is Plato's allegory of the cave, where the person who comes back to explain the illusions, the shadows on the wall, is killed. I think in a healthy society, that's correct. In a society that has the capacity to regenerate itself, to be self-critical, to remain rooted in the real world, that's true. What I fear is that we have unplugged ourselves from the real world to such an extent that those who have that heart and those who speak with that kind of honesty are going to get stoned to death.
Well, Chris, we look forward to you being out there guiding people in the next demonstration and getting off their grid and bringing the battle to them, because we can't just let them win every single time.
No, we
time.
Have to. You're right. And I just did a one-hour talk on YouTube on Trump in Vancouver, which you can, with my name in Vancouver, get, which lays out, I think, a lot of the themes we've discussed today.
Okay. Thank you. We look forward to it. Chris Hedges, my guest on our program today. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you for listening.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you.